ready to do it. Labor is on board. Business is on board. We just need Congress to get on board. Let's put America back to work.
President Obama at a Detroit stop on his 2012 presidential campaign, rallying Americans to support his jobs plan, which he presented to the nation on September 8th. The American Jobs Act will help Americans by cutting payroll taxes and putting people to work, rebuilding the country's infrastructure, said the president. Not at all, says Rob Johnson from the Roosevelt Institute. He argues the president's plan will actually advance the GOP agenda by cutting Medicare, Medicaid, and making tax cuts to pay for that for the plan. He spoke to the Real News Network's Paul Jay and will bring you that discussion. One in six Americans is poor. One in five kids is poor. That's according to the latest information from the Census Bureau. And there's also a major gender issue and disparity to poverty. According to Legal Momentum, the nation's oldest legal defense and education fund dedicated to advancing the rights of women and girls. The organization's president, Elizabeth Greyer, joins us to explain. And it's Thursday, so that means Art in the Apple, where we bring you the world of the arts to the airwaves. And this morning, the world of music from the fierce and fabulous Nona Hendrix and the power of theater with an award-winning new play called Seed. And of course, it's Thursday, so we have ticket giveaways galore. That's to make up for the fun drive that we put you through over the last 2 days. Ticket giveaways galore. All of that and more coming up. Let's start with local, national and global news headlines. We say good morning to Christine Black, our news editor. Christine, good morning.
Good morning, Esther. Here are some of today's headlines. The latest report about the cause of the BP Gulf oil spill last year says BP is primarily to blame for the accident, but it also says Halliburton bears some responsibility because the cement it poured failed to contain the oil and gas. The report also said Transocean, the owner of the Deepwater Horizon oil rig, shared part of the blame. The report by the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, Regulation and Enforcement and the Coast Guard is important because those agencies regulate the offshore oil industry. It contains 50 recommendations for improved safety, including allowing employees to stop drilling if they notice a problem. The 500-page report also says drillers violated 7 federal regulations, including failing to notify regulators when drilling plans changed. In response to the report, BP said it has always maintained responsibility for the blowout, but that blame for the accident should be shared with the subcontractors. Halliburton said they were just following BP's well design and therefore were not as culpable. Transocean defended the action of its employees, saying the cement job failure was named as the primary cause of the accident. The report did say the blowout preventer was not the cause of the accident. The BP Deepwater Horizon drilling rig exploded April 20th last year after the 18,000-foot well went out of control. 11 workers died, and almost 5 million barrels of oil spilled into the ocean before the well was capped. The amount of damage to the environment is still being studied. In Iraq, 20 more people were killed in apparent terrorist attacks in two provinces. In the mostly Sunni province of Anbar, 6 Iraqi soldiers were killed when a bomb exploded inside their bus Wednesday. This came after leaders in Anbar criticized the Iraqi government for not doing enough to protect Shiite pilgrims, 22 of which were killed in the area Monday. In Babil province near Baghdad, a car bomb detonated near a restaurant, killing 13, including women and children. And elsewhere in the province, 3 Shiite men were found dead and bound by the side of the road. There was also a shooting in Baghdad that killed 2 police officers. No one has claimed responsibility, but officials say the attacks appear to be the work of al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia. Officials theorize the group is attacking both Sunnis and Shiites to stir sectarian violence. So far, none of that violence has happened. In the U.S., GM and Chrysler extended their contracts with the UAW after talks slowed down earlier this morning. A similar deal was struck with Ford on Tuesday. The UAW was most focused on discussions with GM. The automaker said they were not willing to increase pay over what workers at Toyota and Honda receive. GM also wanted pay increases in the form of signing bonuses and profit sharing. The UAW wants pay increases for entry-level workers. Talks are set to resume later today. And finally, a rally to stop the execution of Troy Davis in Georgia will be held tomorrow between 4:30 and 6:30 in Times Square at 42nd and 7th Avenues. Sponsors include Amnesty International USA, Campaign to End the Death Penalty, and the Brecht Forum, among others. There is only one more week before Troy Davis is scheduled to be executed. He was accused of killing a white police officer, but the case rested on witness testimony, which contained inconsistencies, even at trial. Since the trial, many of the witnesses have signed sworn affidavits that they were pressured or coerced by police into testifying or signing statements against Mr. Davis. And those are some of the headlines for today. Please send your news tips and reactions to WBAIheadlines@gmail.com. Again, that's WBAIheadlines@gmail.com. Or call and leave a message specifically for Wake Up Call News Headlines. To call 212-209-2815 to leave a comment. Again, that's 212-209-2815. Or tweet me at WBAI Headlines. Follow WBAI Headlines on Twitter for more information on today's stories. I'm Christine Black. Now to Samori Benjamin for sports headlines.
Home run by Rodriguez leads to walk-off out west. The Major League Baseball playoffs began 2 weeks from today. So with the regular season coming to an end, the first-place New York Yankees are closing in on clinching their American League East division over their arch-rival Boston Red Sox, and they're also closing in on clinching home field advantage throughout the American League playoffs. Last night, the Bronx Bombers were out on the West Coast in Seattle, looking to sweep the Seattle Mariners in the three-game series after winning the previous two games on Monday and Tuesday night. Never able to get close to that, but I definitely have been watching these Little League World Series since I was about 11, 12, 10 years old, maybe even a little younger. So this is late 80s, early 90s. I've been watching these things. And, of course, you've seen black ball players. There have even been all-black teams that have been in the Little League World Series. Not recently, but actually the Harlem Little League, the league that I played for when I was coming up playing Little League, the Harlem Little League made the Little League World Series in 2002, which was amazing. That team was mostly African-American kids, but there were some Spanish kids on the team as well. And together, they put forth a great run and really did something that I never thought. The magic number to clinch the division is 11. The Yankees are off today before traveling to Toronto for a weekend series with the Blue Jays. As for the Mets, who are winding down their string, they were 2-0 losers at home to the Washington Nationals. And finally, this weekend marks week two of the NFL football season. In week one, the New York football Giants, who suffered a lot of injuries in preseason, were 28-14 losers to the Washington Redskins despite leading the game 14-7 in the first half. The Jets had a thrilling 27-24 win over the Dallas Cowboys after trailing 24-10 at the start of the fourth quarter. The Jets will host Jacksonville on Sunday, while the Giants will host St. Louis the following night at home in prime time on Monday Night Football. But folks, the game of the week here in week two will take place on Sunday night down in Atlanta in front of the nation as Philadelphia Eagles quarterback Michael Vick returns to his former home, the Georgia Dome, and takes on the team and the fans where his career began before his arrest on dogfighting charges. The scene will be electric, and we'll talk about it on Monday morning. This is Samori Benjamin, and that's sports.
Thank you, Samori. 10 minutes past seven. One in six Americans is poor. One in five kids is poor. One in 10 kids is living in deep poverty. Deep poverty being defined as a family of four living on $11,000. But yeah, now more than half of those numbers are black and Latino. That's according to the latest information from the Census Bureau. But there's also a gender issue and disparity with poverty. According to Legal Momentum, the nation's oldest legal defense and education fund dedicated to advancing the rights of women and girls. Their report, Reading Between the Lines, Women's Poverty in United States 2010, notes that, quote, the 40.7% poverty rate for solo mother families was 68% greater than the 24.2% rate for solo father families. unquote. To talk about gender and poverty, we're now joined by Elizabeth Grayer, president of Legal Momentum. Elizabeth, good morning. Welcome to Wake Up Call.
Good morning. Thank you so much. Delighted to be here.
Thank you for joining us. So, I kind of gave a little snippet of the information, but really lay out the way in which poverty is impacting women.
Absolutely. As you pointed out, the poverty numbers overall are quite grim, and they're even more grim when you look at it from the perspective of women. Unfortunately, there is a gender gap in many things, there is a gender gap in poverty, and women are much more likely in this country than men to be poor. In fact, adult women are 29% more likely than adult men to be poor here. So the poverty rate in 2010 for adult women was about 14.5%, and for adult men, it was just a little bit over 11%. And as you mentioned, I think you were talking about the extreme poverty rate, but even the poverty rate means $14,000 a year in income for a family of three. So there is this very unfortunate fact that in this country at the moment, women are simply much more likely to be poor than men are, and that is particularly acute in two groups. One, in the world of single parents, as you noted, over 40% of single mother-headed households are likely to be living below, or in fact are living below the poverty level in this country. That's 68% higher than single-headed male families. You also see this huge disparity between male and female families at age 65 and above. So women with kids and elderly women are much, much more likely to be poor than their male counterparts.
And talk about the different factors that contribute to what makes women liable to higher numbers of women to be in poverty in comparison to men.
Sure. Looking, for example, at the single mothers, I think it's probably a number of factors. One of the primary ones is that the women tend to be the primary caregivers. So given the high cost and limited availability of child care in this country, I think that is a factor. There's also, in this country, occupational segregation. Many of the low-wage, part-time, inconsistent jobs are in fields that are primarily dominated by women, and so that tends to be where they work. Because one of the startling facts about this is that many of the women, many of the single mothers living in poverty work full or part-time. So it's not a question of not working. In many instances, it's the result of the fact that the jobs that they're working at have very low wages or very limited hours.
And talk about the kind of response that is needed given those really troubling figures and figures that are increasing and just getting higher and higher and expanding.
Absolutely. I think a couple of responses are needed. In the long term, it's clear that we do need more jobs and more better jobs, particularly for women. If we can put these women to work at jobs that take them above the poverty line, then that will help with this problem. It will help them. It will help their children. But that is not going to happen fast enough, even if it does start to happen soon, which we all hope. What we really need to do in the short term is to improve the safety net. Right now, the benefits that are available, the government assistance that is available to help these women and their children, are really not adequate. The amount in dollars available, for example, in cash assistance these days under the TANF program, which is the primary federal cash assistance program, amount in most states to no more than $15 a day for a family of three. And also, the benefits are not easily accessible. It's very hard to get them. So while the poverty rate has been going up, the number of people served by these programs has been going down. And that's not right. In fact, we as a society are the least generous and the least helpful to the people and living in extreme poverty of any of the wealthy nations out there.
And you talk about the barriers that prevent eligible families from accessing benefits like the temporary assistance to needy families, the National Welfare Program for Families with Children. Explain why you say that is inadequate, and then explain the barriers that do prevent eligible families from even accessing what is still considered inadequate.
Sure. I think it's inadequate because even if you do qualify, the amount of the benefit is simply too low to lift anybody out of poverty, frankly, to even lift, in most states, people out of extreme poverty, which is measured at about half the poverty rate. And that is, as I said, if what you're getting for a family of three amounts to about $5 a day per person, you really just can't live on that. It is helpful, of course, it's better than nothing, but it is not enough to establish any sort of financial security, food security, home security for a family of three. So the amounts just aren't big enough. And you combine that with, as I said, the difficulty that people have accessing the benefits. They have set up in many states sufficient bureaucracy around getting to the benefits that it frankly discourages people from applying. They require various documents, meetings, things like that. I completely understand that there is a need to verify eligibility. You don't want people taking advantage of these programs. You want them to go to people who are eligible and could really use the help. But if you make it too hard and too many steps for the people who really need the help to access the programs, then they simply won't be able to do it, and having the program doesn't do much good.
So then as we close, what do you say needs to happen right now in order to start to address what is an expanding gap that is just devastating people's lives?
I think we need to improve TANF, make the benefits higher, and make them more accessible to families who really need it. We need to extend unemployment insurance, make sure that we do not interfere and only extend programs like food stamps so that we really make sure that the safety net is adequate, is available to families, to children who are living in extreme poverty in this, a very rich nation.
Elizabeth Gray, President of Legal Momentum, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
717, this is Wake Up Call.
Greetings. The Earth Center cordially invites the community to come and enjoy an afternoon of vending, performances, workshops, storytelling, and more at its annual Healthy Life Festival. The theme this year will be Keeping a Clean Heart. We will be featuring traditional Kemetic meditation workshops and an invigorating West African dance class. The Earth Center is an international nonprofit spiritual organization dedicated to preserving, protecting, and promoting traditional culture throughout the world. We invite everyone to come and visit us at our new storefront location in Brooklyn, New York, 405 Leopards Avenue. We can be reached at 347-529-1399. We look forward to seeing you there. And remember, the sun never sets. It is man who moves away from the light. The Healthy Life Festival on October 15th and 16th from 12 to 6 p.m. 405 Leopards Avenue. For information, call 347-529-1399. And again, 347-529-1399.
An annual high school journalism workshop is accepting applicants for its fall session. First Take, which is put on by the New York Association of Black Journalists, is looking for dynamic students from across the tri-state area for its 8-week multimedia program, which starts Saturday, October 1st. Students can download the application at First Take website. That's www.firsttakenyc.com. That's www.firsttakenyc.com. The application deadline is September 23rd. For more information, contact Nikesa Moody at info@firsttakenyc.com.
719, now on September 8th, President Obama presented his jobs plan to the nation. The American Jobs Act will help Americans by cutting payroll taxes and putting people to work, rebuilding the country's infrastructure. Not so, says Rob Johnson from the Roosevelt Institute. He argues that the president's plan will actually advance the GOP's agenda by cutting Medicare and Medicaid and making tax cuts to pay for the plan. He discusses the speech and the plan with Paul Jay from the Real News Network. Take a listen.
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Paul Jay in Washington. Thursday night in Washington, President Obama delivered his jobs speech. Here's a little excerpt from it.
The American Jobs Act will repair and modernize at least 35,000 schools. It will put people to work right now, fixing roofs and windows, installing science labs and high-speed internet in classrooms all across this country. in addition to the $1 trillion of spending cuts I've already signed into law. It's a balanced plan that would reduce the deficit by making additional spending cuts, by making modest adjustments to health care programs like Medicare and Medicaid, and by reforming our tax code in a way that asks the wealthiest Americans and biggest corporations to pay their fair share.
Now joining us from California is Rob Johnson. He's a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. Thanks for joining us again, Rob.
My pleasure.
So, first of all, have you got a sense of how much money is going to what? It wasn't, he didn't say any of that in the speech.
Well, my understanding is there's going to be a plan outlined with quantitative numbers next Monday. But the indications are a $10 billion infrastructure bank, about $100 billion in infrastructure, $35, $40 billion transferred to teachers, basically state and local government transfers, some payroll tax cuts. Don't know the order of magnitude, but the various little bits and pieces that I picked up over the course of the day are a little bit over $330 billion.
Some of the press is saying $450 billion, but it's not clear how they get to that number.
That's correct, and that might be that the infrastructure bank levers at 5-1 or something, and so we just have to await the details.
So what's your main take of the speech?
Number one. It's a good statement by Obama about what he thinks matters, what constitutes a strong economy, what's needed to go forward. Number two, it's too small. This is not a little patch that expires in 2013 to get everybody elected with a bump. It should be a longer and bigger structural program. So I'm critical in that regard. Number three, the composition of the dollars is not creating the greatest impact. When they are talking about cutting taxes, we need real spending and infrastructure spending. And when they tell you they're worried about Social Security and they're cutting the payroll taxes, that's a bit of an awkward dilemma by itself. So overall, I would say too small, composition's not right, but it's a step in the right direction.
Well, a step in terms of the language at any rate. But how it's being paid for, number one, is payroll tax, which is going to affect Social Security. And two, he again talks about cuts to Medicaid and Medicare as part of increasing this $1.5 trillion cuts that they're supposed to be doing. What do you make of that as a way to pay for all this?
Well, the cuts that we need are negotiated pharmaceutical prices rather than monopolies pharmaceutical prices in Medicare. The cuts that we need are reduced insurance rates that single payer would have afforded us that insurance monopolies state by state are just way too expensive compared to other nations and other developed country healthcare plans. So I would say it's not the quality of services, it's not the age, it's the monopoly pricing and the costs that really have to be attacked. And I see no sign of either party in Congress or the president wanting to take that on.
No, in fact, President Obama made a deal with pharma when he negotiated the health care bill. And in this speech, he says the problem is demographics. That's the threat to the health.
Well, the demographics tell you when it switches on. The demographics tell you when those monopoly costs hit the budget and put us into a fiscal strife or accelerate the debt to GDP ratio. But it would accelerate much more slowly, as the paper Tom Ferguson and I wrote. We cite Dean Baker, who says if you had Canadian, German, French, or UK health plans as a percentage of GDP rather than the American plan, which is 6-7% of GDP less, you don't have a crisis. So a cheaper plan, and by the way, World Health Organization rates those plans higher in terms of delivery than the current American healthcare system for lower cost, much better value. Then you don't have a budget crisis. But now, nobody's taking on those concentrated interests in the healthcare industry right now.
Yeah, there's no mention of any of that. Now, to a large extent, this was a political speech. Most analysts are saying a lot of this more stimulus money is unlikely to get passed by the House. What he probably will get is the tax cut, because the tax cuts, sort of play into the Republican narrative anyway. But if that's the case, that this is more a political speech, maybe the beginning of the 2012 election campaign, how do you rate it?
Well, I read it that Obama says, as he often used to say, I get it, that this suffering and this stress and this level of unemployment is unacceptable. Now, the Republicans will match him and say, we get it too. You got to remember, not just Republican, not just Democrat, all of these people are now what you call incumbents up for re-election with plummeting approval rates. So they all want to take a little sting out of the economy. Whose beak gets salted? Which special interests? Which sectors? Taxes versus spending, all those things will be thought about, but they all share an interest. But Obama's the one that stepped forward and set the tone that said, we have to focus on employment. And I think he'll get a little bit of a bump from that. And I think if he stays on it and he keeps fighting, he will get, how would I say, more credit than Congress will going into the presidential election year. So it's good political tactics. I wish it was a little bit larger public policy, meaning the Sputnik moment he spoke about at the State of the Union.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about this. This didn't feel like a Sputnik moment.
No, this feels like a political game. But Obama's very clever. He comes out and he talks about corruption and bridges to nowhere and the people don't trust the government. And he talks about the people hiring the Congress to do a job and that they're not doing their job. So at some level, he's running against Washington, talking about being responsive to the people, but he's not really rebuilding America. Though I'll give him credit, he did say this is the first of many actions that will be necessary to rebuild America. So at least he's acknowledging, understanding the logic that this isn't enough and it isn't sufficient.
So if you go beyond the D.C. theater, how dangerous a moment are we actually in terms of the economy? The reason this speech is being given is not, it's partly because of the crashes, the market crash, the crisis in Europe, generally a feeling around the globe that the global economy is heading into much deeper recession. I didn't get a sense of the real nature of the danger from this speech. How dangerous do you think it is?
Well, I think there are several dimensions to the danger, the first of which is the potential for contagion associated with the European crisis that propagates through the entire world banking system. It's like a Lehman moment that would originate in Europe. I don't think that that's entirely, how would I say, the most probable outcome, but there's enough smoke there to think there may be a fire, and that is dangerous. That could harm the whole world in a synchronized way, just like 2008 did. The second dimension, which Christine Lagarde spoke about as she came into the IMF, is this notion of doing austerity all over the world into a slump in a synchronized manner can really make a depression out of a mild, you might say, growth recession. And I think that's a big danger as well. I think that the attempt to protect creditors, bankers, and bondholders from not experiencing restructuring and putting all of these economies through the wringer is very, very bad policy. It's very bad policy in each country, and it, because of what you might call the cross-reinforcement effects, it's very bad policy for the whole world.
So if President Obama was to exercise some leadership here, shouldn't he have addressed some of these kinds of issues? Because that's the real nature of the danger is in what you were talking about, it seems to me.
Well, I would say that President Obama today is talking to people about jobs and a domestic political agenda in America. I think those international ramifications heighten the anxiety. I think those international spillovers from a fiscal austerity are important, but they're not the first order of business that he wanted to communicate today. I think there are lots of places where he should speak and exercise leadership in a world community, much stronger on financial regulation, much stronger on what Andrew Scheng at the IMET conference in Bretton Woods called the Godzilla banks, and much more coordinated macroeconomic policies. I do not give...
What do an herbalist, a stock trader, a biologist, and a human resources maven all have in common? They're all sheroes at the Women in the Making Career and Leadership Summit, a personal and professional development event for women in the making ages 11 to 19. The summit will take place here at WBAI Studios at 120 Wall Street on Saturday, October 1st, from 10:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. The Wim Shiro panel is back and will address entrepreneurship, navigating the workplace as a woman, fair pay in the workplace, and tips for success. There'll be breakfast provided by Gary Knowles Whole Foods and Starbucks, lunch, raffle prizes for various career fields, fun mock interviews, and goodie swag bags. Our girls are the best investment on Wall Street. Visit brownpapertickets.com and search for Women in the Making Career and Leadership Summit.
Voza, Rivers, New Heritage Theater, and Take Wing and Soar Productions present Savior, the brand new fast-paced provocative play by me, Esther Amar, directed by Passion. Two men, Billy Hall, Michael Jamal Williams III. One man in trouble, one man on a mission. One black, one white. One's an attorney, one's a client. Family, secrets, ambition, pride, media, white privilege, race, frustration, law, love, loyalty, justice. It's all on the line in this play that asks, who's saving who? It opens Friday, October 7th. On that night after the play, Council Member Charles Barron joins me, Esther Amar, for a discussion on the black and white of activism leadership. Come on out. For more info, call 212-352-3101 or go to takewingandsoar.org. It is 7:31. It's a Thursday, so that means it's time for Art in the Apple. And in this segment, we bring the worlds of film, music, theatre, visual art, spoken word, from the colours, cultures, accents of New York's communities to life and to the airwaves. This morning, the world of the stage, music and theatre. A fiery mosaic of music, film and spoken word performance, courtesy of musician Nona Hendricks, filmmaker Nelson George and artist Carl Hancock Rux. And the world premiere of an award-winning play called Seed by Rada Blank, directed by Neagle Smith. And tickets, tickets, tickets. We have giveaways galore this morning, so grab the number 212-209-2900. Again, that's 212-209-2900. But don't call until 8 a.m. because nobody's going to pick up that phone. All of that coming up on Art in the Apple. And we start with the legendary musician, Ms. Nona Hendricks, author, filmmaker Nelson George, and comedic monologist Reno, who present a fiery mosaic of music, film, and spoken word performance at Right Now, a We the People's Cabaret, curated by award-winning poet, playwright, recording artist Carl Hancock Rux, as part of the Uptown Nights at Harlem Stage series on Saturday, September 17th at the Harlem Stage Gatehouse. And you know, wake up call has got you taken care of with two pairs of free tickets to enjoy for the Saturday night event. So let me take the number again, 212-209-2900 if you'd like to win a pair. But we're going to start with the sound of some transformation. Oh, Transformation. Everybody, and I know anybody in New York who does not know the sound of the one and only Ms. Nona Hendrix. And we're joined live now by vocalist, producer, songwriter, musician, author, and actress born in the tri-state, graduated to her own artistic musical state. We got some female trouble up on the mic. Not zero cool, but major all the way cool. Our very own Bell, Ms. Nona Hendrix, live. Good morning, Ms. Nona.
Good morning to you.
Thank you for joining us. Unfortunately, my mic was, I was getting ready to do my dance to Transformation that I've been practicing all morning, and I didn't know the mic was still on, so you kind of heard me. I would never dare, but you know, and everybody knows that me on a mic.
That was cool.
So, this amazing night right now, Saturday night, take us through what we can expect on that night.
You can expect, funky music, of course, and, political, conversations, social issues, political issues discussed, sexual issues discussed in terms of talking about the truth about things that we don't often hear in a musical setting, and things that will make you laugh, things that will make you cry, things that will make you think, which is the important part of this evening, is to motivate people to think, to get into their heads, to ask questions, to have conversation, dialogue, communicate.
And it's been described as a rock and soul melange. I know that you're going to talk a bit about your musical history as the main writer of one third of the trio La Belle, as well as your own solo career. And we know you as this extraordinary writer who brings all this kind of provocative and powerful input to your music. But this is a really intimate setting in which you're going to deliver this performance. Talk a bit about the process of creating this show and the kinds of discussions that you want to have with the audience.
Well, it comes from Carl's curating, bringing this together, Carl Hancock Lux, and then Nelson George, who is always on the cutting edge of discussion about what's going on within the community. And when I say community, I mean the world globally, because we are a global community now.
Absolutely.
But also the things that, for me, that I would bring to it is a new album of music or collection of songs that about things that have, over the past, I'd say probably 10 years, have happened in our country, going back to Katrina all the way through to the oil spill in Florida, to the horrible vitriol that goes on a lot of radio shows since the election of President Obama, some people that maybe I won't name this morning because I don't want people to throw up their breakfast, and on the political side, some of the things that issues that the Tea Party have brought up, and I have a song called The Tea Party, and the We Party, he can't be a she and she can't be a he party.
Ooh, I like that. Ooh, I like that. The Tea Party chat. That like.
Yes. And the song, there's a song called Oil on the Water, which is you can't be washed away by rain. It's something that's going to stay with us. There's a song called Black on Black, talking about black on black violence, and where did we learn that? Where does that come from? And, ongoing issues. And then there's a song, of course, called Let's Give Love a Try, which is ultimately what we need to get to when we try to find an answer to all of these things that I bring up, and that everyone, many people have issues and need to talk about and communicate about. And I want to, and Carl wants to, and says, Nelson, we want to, people aren't talking anymore. People aren't really being as activists as they could be.
Don't we all need to do that? Let's give love a try. That needs to be an anthem right now for the times that we're living it, doesn't it, though? I mean, that's like anthemic. To bring all of those names into one space, onto one stage, all these years of creating such amazing music, I just think to be blessed with a kind of a mixture of talent and politics. And let's just be honest, the fly is still there. You've maintained that after all these years. The fly and the fierce is still there.
Thank you.
That what happens to you on the stage musically that is different years and years ago? How's that changed for you?
I think, as a solo artist, it took me time to find my own voice and my own ownership of the stage. And for me, I think I don't know when I crossed the line, but at some point I crossed that line and I have this direct, for me, communication with the audience. Sometimes it starts with one person, eye-to-eye contact, which opens up the rest of the room for me. So the show, the space at Harlem Stage is small, but it feels to me gigantic. It feels like a stadium. And I have the same sense of strength and communication there, you know, on a one-to-one, on a tiny space, that I feel I do in very large spaces.
Mm. So the way you occupy the space is different as well, I guess. When you're on the stage by yourself, it's purely your energy that is reaching the crowd versus the energy of all these combined voices and creators that are up there taking that mic and on that space.
Yes, and I'm present. I'm there. I'm not somewhere else in what, you know, some sort of other place or fake place. I'm in the music, the music's in me, and I'm with you.
So powerful. So powerful. So this is all happening Saturday night. It's called Right Now. It's actually inspired by the late performance poet Sekou Sandiata. The extraordinary Sekou. Yeah, your memories of Sekou before we close, Miss Nona.
Sekou, he introduced me to the authenticity, really, of occupying that space on stage. You know, I knew it, and I was a part of it, but somehow performing with him and being with him and talking with him on and off stage, there was such a clarity to what it was that he was doing and saying and how he was being and the intensity of him on stage. He was just absolutely and a lovely, lovely person, as is Carl, and I don't know Reno, but I, you know, bringing all this together is... it's a wonderful evening for people. It takes me to the, you know, some of the events that I did with Sekou. That's what it reminds me of.
And there was right now, of course, it was a project that Sekou created post 9/11 and what it meant to be an American. I actually remember at I think it was Harlem Stage, and a conversation with Carl Hancock Rux and Michaela Angela Davis about exploring that, and it was just. Sekou Sandiata was like, wow, just like this unique being, creation. I don't know if there's any real language for the kind of, just the beauty of one artistic human being and how many people he touched and affected their creativity, made their creativity better because of who he was. Really an extraordinary man. Really
maestro.
An extraordinary man. And so.
A maestro of human collection.
Yeah, I'm interested in what you said about he helped you own that space as a solo artist on stage and be there in an authentic and a different intentional way than before. And I imagine how scared you would get transitioning from being in a group to being on the stage by yourself, what it meant to own that authentically. To almost, and to be present, which is to feel your own spirit as it kind of moves around you when you're in this musical creative space, and how challenging it was to get to a place of comfort and to own that and kind of feel its power rather than be scared of its power.
Yeah, well, you know, there were times when, say, Sekou would just do something on stage with nothing, just himself, his voice, his body, making rhythms with his feet, his hands, and his voice. And that's a very powerful thing to be able to do. That's the beginning of how we made music, how we communicated with each other. And for me to start as a solo coming out of a very powerful group like LaBelle and with an amazing singer like Patty and working with Sarah, how we worked as a trio, I had to find that, you know, Patty was the lead singer and she occupied that space primarily, although we worked together like a well-oiled machine at times. Getting out there in front of people, my first tour was opening for Peter Gabriel. So I wasn't going to, you know, a small club somewhere in the hinterlands finding my feet. I was out on a traveling in Europe, and I had to do that, and it was frightening to begin with. And but I guess the strength that was given to me from my family, from my mother, who was a very strong woman, and then working with strong women over the years, I was able to say, if I'm going to do this, I need to do it now.
Mm. And own that.
And it's like, if not now, when?
Mm. For real.
And that's, you know, from someone like Sekou, seeing him, watching him do that process on stage really solidified that for me.
So powerful. It's called Right Now. It's being described as a fiery mosaic of music, film, and spoken word performance. And Carl Nelson George, who's the legendary filmmaker, will actually be ruminating on the enduring impact of Gil Scott Heron's protest masterpiece. And he's also going to introduce a short film by Hancock Rux about the record produced with longtime Tangerine Dream member Peter Bowman. That's all happening this Saturday, September 17th. For more information, you can call 212-281-9240. That's 212-281-9240. Happening Saturday night. But you know we got you, so we got two pairs of tickets to give away this morning. Don't start calling them, because I know these phones are going to start blowing up, because everyone wants to see Ms. Mona on stage again. 212-209-2900. Yeah, they're yummy giveaways this morning. 212-209-2900 for your free ticket giveaways just before 8 a.m. But for now, Ms. Nona, we're bowing at the mic like you can't see me. Prostrating. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You too.
Take
care.
Your place sounds very interesting.
Oh, great. You should come see it.
Yes, I will come see it.
Cool. Well, I'll see you on Saturday, because I'll definitely be in the audience.
Okay.
Take care. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. From the world of music to the world of the stage, and an award-winning off-Broadway debut of a powerhouse play presented by the Classical Theatre of Harlem and Hip Hop Theatre Festival. It's called Seed by Rudder Blank, and it's directed by Neagle Smith. It is playing right now at the National Black Theatre in Harlem. Now, Seed explores themes of abandonment, poverty, class differences, and byproducts of the crack epidemic that swept through Harlem in the 1980s and 90s. It tells the story using rhythm and verse integral to hip-hop culture and examines class and cultural fault lines in one of America's most prominent black communities. And Seed begs this question: how far are you willing to go to protect the future of a community and its children? How far are you willing to go? And we have two pairs of tickets to give away for this award-winning play for next Wednesday's performance, Wednesday, September 21st, that night. And the number again, 212-209-2900, if you'd like to win one of those pairs. But let's talk to the play's director now, Neagle Smith. Neagle, good morning. Welcome to Wake Up Call.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you so much. Up bright and early. Wow, what a powerhouse play. And, I mean, I've just given people a snippet of what it's about. You lay it out for us from your space, what this play is about and what folks can expect to see on the stage.
Oh, great. Well, first, thank you for having me on this morning. It's really wonderful to be able to have to talk a bit about the play. We've been working for 2.5 years on bringing this to the stage in Harlem, and what Rada Blank, the playwright, has been attempting to do is to create a space where many layers of Harlem can come to the fore and really battle it out over what it means to raise our children and what it means to be a community that takes the the future of its children quite seriously. The story centers around Chi-Chi Bryant, a gifted African-American boy who is being forced to hide what it is that makes him special, his ability to learn and recite and to be bright. It comes to a really complex and passionate ending where the mother and the social worker and the father are all seeing that he is doing what he can do.
And so, I mean, it's all these explosive, really painful themes being explored, but a lot of humor in there as well. I wonder if you could talk a bit about the process of just bringing this up on its feet and some of the challenges of using that personal story to talk about these huge themes that in some ways literally raised a community to the ground and caused such havoc in, you know, what family was not touched on some level by the crack epidemic. That's what it felt like back at that time.
Yes. Well, you know, it's been a process of delving deep into a rehearsal process with the actors where we start to excavate the personal histories that we all bring into the room. You know, Radha is a child of Harlem. Several of our performers are from Harlem. So several of them are from the rural South. And each character, each is moving beyond personal traumas that are shaping their presence and their past. So we would go in and start to figure out what is it that makes someone tick? What is it that shifts how someone thinks about parenting or thinks about childhood? One of the characters, for instance, has been through a history of physical and sexual abuse, she is visited by a social worker who's also been through a same history. And so in recalling those memories, recalling that space, it's very important to create a place that is both nuanced and real and allows for the artist to reach those difficult emotions while being protected. You know, we dealt a lot with sense memory as well as imagery to get there. And then there's also this connection to parenting and grandparenting. And so there's a lot of singing of songs and telling personal narratives in order to reach back. There is work around music, and as you know from the play, the play uses rhyme, uses hip-hop, uses poetry, uses gospel to better show and to express character. And so there was work and rehearsal around what was the best songs to indicate any specific moment or to lift a character into a place of speaking. So it was a difficult and challenging process, but I think one that ultimately unveiled the many spirits going on inside of one person. And also, you know, there was work around what does it mean to go the furthest limit, to go all out for someone, to take pleasure in their gifts, to take risk for their gifts. I was very lucky to be blessed with a cast who is willing to go to any lengths for telling a story. It's a physically demanding piece. You know, our main performer is on stage for almost every minute of the first act. I remember the moment where I had to cut her one break, and because I really wanted the audience to be experiencing the piece from her point of view. and she literally takes a step off stage, grabs a drink of water, and returns because she's completely wrapped up in the life of this young child, Chi-Chi, and I wanted the audience to feel that same kind of urgency around her, her choice and around his life.
And no, there's two things that I think are really powerful. The way that rhythm is infused into the story without interrupting the narrative or the emotional power of the piece. And sometimes it's, you think, how do you bring this form into this space and not have it interrupt something that is so emotionally powerful? But also that something that is as powerful and as raw and as real, and there is a real naked beauty to the way Rada has written this, that it must be transformational. Like, you can't be the same person at the beginning of the process as you were. Now you're on stage every night. And for you as a director, just going through standing up on its feet and imagining and working and envisioning, how do you extract the purest emotion from this space so that we, the audience, feel it, like right in the back row, in the corner, like you feel it in your soul. Like, it must be a transformational experience, and what that was for you.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Rada and I have a very close relationship. Like I said, we've been working on this play for 2.5 years, and there's an authenticity to her voice, and there is a deep love and passion for these characters. And one of the great joys of working on a new play is that you have the playwright right there in the room with you to turn to. And what she's done is she's crafted individuals. And they represent, of course, different folks in our society and the fabric of Harlem and the fabric of New York. But each of them has their own cadence. They have their own point of view. And she was able to, give us all of the deep underpinnings of each person. It was, really difficult, to get in and understand how a young mother from the projects would, despite her deep love for her son, might ask him to become more hood.
That's a powerful story. This is one of those plays where you can't ignore, you can't step away from, and it provokes all kinds of conversations and emotions, and puts you into this space of immediate history and the legacy of that untreated trauma from the crack epidemic, and what it does and how it can, you know, cripple us emotionally in some ways. And I think the beauty and the power of the piece is to create all of that on a stage, and you can't give away the ending, so I'm not going to do that, but it is one of those powerhouses that cannot be ignored. So it's playing right now at the National Black Theatre in Harlem from Wednesdays through to Sundays. One of those places, like I said, do not sleep on that. National Black Theatre of Harlem, it's opened right now, so it's available for you to go see. But we have two pairs of tickets to see next Wednesday's 8 p.m. performance. That Seed, award-winning off-Broadway major debut by Rada Blank, directed by Negal Smith, who we've been in conversation with. The number to call for those tickets, or to see Miss Nana Hendricks and Nelson George and Carl Hancock Rocks at the Harlem stage on Saturday, 212-209-2900. 212-209-2900. Negal Smith, you created something very special indeed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That brings us to the end of this morning's Wake Up Call. Get your tickets, 212-209-2900. If you want to go see the theatre on Wake Up Call, or want to go and check out Miss Nona Hendricks along with Nelson George and Carl Hancock Rux on Saturday, then make that call, 212-209-2900. That brings us to the end of this morning's Wake Up Call, this week's Wake Up Call with me, Esther Armour. Thank you to the entire Wake Up Call team. That's Sharan, Louise Harper, our executive producer, Christine Black, our news headlines editor, Samori Benjamin, our sports headlines editor, Rita Rahman and Dean Clark, Wake Up Call producers, Ife Dancy, our engineer. If you would like to check me out on Facebook under my name, Esther Armour, I continue many of the conversations that we start here under my name, Esther Armour, on Facebook. Coming up, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. You've been listening to Wake Up Call. This is WBAI New York 99.5 FM. I'm Esther Armour. Good morning, New York.